Where are you going, my little one, little one? Where are you going, my baby, my own? Turn around and you're two. Turn around and you're four. Turn around and you're a young girl going out of my door. Turn around and you're a young girl going out of my door. The time goes fast. My little girls are 46 years old. How did that happen? As we drove along the main street of Picton, Ontario, a few summers ago, I noticed that there was a church for sale. A church. A beautiful red brick church, huge, with a center spire, for sale. A church for sale. $250,000. A church for sale. My sister-in-law, who is very imaginative, said, "Imagine what we could do with that. It would become a destination in Prince Edward County, an outdoor cafe in the summer with colored umbrellas and a special drink called Communion Cha-Cha, mixed up specially the way with, and then a high-end restaurant during the winter months with all kinds of locally caught and locally grown food, and then a theater in the summer and musical venues and fashion shows and children's programming and book launches and art exhibits and body painting." I said, "No to that. It's not body. Wrong temperature these days for body painting. Read the headlines." It made me ask then, what is the essence of a church? What's the essence? We can have novelty, and we can have curiosity, that's okay, and we can have spectacle. And that will bring people for a little while just wondering what the noise is about. But beyond that, what is authentic? What is compelling about the church? A few years ago, a United Church minister in Toronto said she wanted to organize an event with very famous people, artists and writers and known celebrities in the country, who would gather to tell an audience moments where they felt they met an authentic version of a living God. That was the theme. Have you ever met the sacred in your life? And she felt she couldn't do it at her church for some reason. So she said, "Let me do it here at Metropolitan, your church." So we said, "Sure." So she took a month and she organized four Sunday nights and brought in speakers to speak on that theme. And she covered up every religious symbol in the place. It was just to be a hall. And to my amazement, when people like Romeo Dallaire came to speak on the theme, "Have you ever encountered a living God in your life?" the church was full, top to bottom, every single seat with people under 35, full, every night of the 4 weeks. I learned something that night. What is authentic and what is compelling in a great church? And then I thought there are two elements in the makeup of a great church. One is a sense of spiritual presence. It's not just us gathering and standing around in the pews. It isn't even just us at our best. There is something else which has compelled us to be here from a very deep place, walks with us until we get here, and then does something to us individually and as a group in the midst. A sense of spiritual presence beyond ourselves. And the process is that it softens us and it warms our hearts together until we are willing to lay down our lives for our friends. Those are the essences of a great church: a spiritual presence which lifts us up, and a spirit that warms us and softens us so that we are willing at some point in our existence to lay down our life for our friends. The Spirit falls, as the text says in Acts, and we experience its effervescence. As they worshipped, the Spirit fell on them, says Luke. They went out open-hearted to tell and to listen and to be models of great things. Well, I think the Spirit fell on us today as we witnessed and participated in the baptism of children. We hear the promises of inclusion and belonging which family members make with all their hearts. And we hear this great congregation pledging to support and encourage these families and these children and all under our care. Baptism is the on-ramp to the highway of eternal life. And today these families and these children have put on their high beams, turned onto the on-ramp, and are heading for eternal life. Today the church is alive and the church is full and it bears fruit. Not so long ago, I met a couple I hadn't seen for a long time. They used to come by here on occasion, but they live out of town. They were here for the weekend, and they met me in the aisle, and we talked a while and reminisced about the old days. And then I noticed a very charming young woman standing beside them. She was in her middle 20s, and I said, "Who is this?" They said, "This is our daughter. She just finished her PhD, and she's working in engineering, and she has a very bright life ahead of her, and you baptized her." I said, "I did." "Yes, you held her in your arms as a little baby and you baptized her." And she smiled at me, and I realized that promises of quality and caring, a gift of a sacrament and a loving family, bear fruit, beautiful fruit, further down the road. Well, the church is full because we are more deeply connected than we realize. It was a big step for Peter, a fisherman from rural Galilee, to go to the city of Joppa. Now, the city of Joppa is the modern city of Jaffa in Israel. It had been a natural harbor for 7,500 years. In the annals of Thutmose III, the pharaoh of Egypt, we are told that he captured the city of Joppa long ago. And Alexander the Great came and conquered it. And the Roman legions used it as a base for their work in the conquest of the Holy Land. And Richard the Lionheart conquered it during the Crusades, and Napoleon Bonaparte conquered it during his reign as emperor. And today, Jaffa, is the bedrock of the city of Tel Aviv, the largest city in Israel. Well, as Peter made his way to Joppa, he realized that the church is full. He got thinking of the variety of people he had met along the way and the keenness of their intentions and the sparkle in their eyes and the talent they possessed. They were leaders in the culture in the towns where they lived. I remember a pastoral theology professor one time saying, "There's really some value in people meeting you in the aisles after the service. You shake hands, hello, how are you, how are you?" And there's even more value in people meeting you in your office. You can sit down for a while and talk about things. And there's even more value you meeting people in their home. That's a little more intimate, a little more aware of their surroundings. But the greatest place, the greatest impact for a ministerial visit is to a place where somebody works. You go to where they work, and you see their office, and you meet their people. They see you on a Sunday in your strength. When you go to their office, you see them in their strength. They are proud to show you who they are and what their world looks like. I never forgot that. Peter was becoming full because the church was full. He recognized the quality of the people he met. I was sitting in my office the other day just working on something for today, and Jackie in our front office called and said, "I'm bringing up someone who wants to look at the space. It's a rental, and she wants to see all our rooms." I said, "Fine, come on up." And this woman, 50-plus, with short silver hair, came in, and Jackie said, "This woman is from Act 2. Act 2 is a theater school or a theater company that used to meet at Ryerson University but meets other places now. And it's for people who are retired and would like to do some amateur theater. And they are getting so many requests that they have to find different places to rehearse. And they thought that some of our rooms may be of use to them." And I looked at this woman and I said, "I do accents, you know. Want to hear them? Hello there, good morning everybody, and how are you doing today?" "Oh," I say, "old boy, I can do any accent you want, and I can dance too a little bit, and I've done theater." And Jackie said, "What in the world are you doing?" I said, "I'm auditioning for the rest of my life. I've got talent in front of me here. I've met the broader community, and I love it. Oh, please take me, take me." She said, "Are there any other rooms we could see?" We are more deeply connected to each other than we know. We share common joys and common sadness, and we breathe the same air, and we ride the same roads, and we all need the strength of bread and the refreshment of water, and we all face the same issues on the same planet. We all fear ill health, we fear bad government, social chaos, personal impoverishment, and the longing to be valued. We all want to be valued. If you remember from last Sunday morning's sermon, I mentioned I had an angel at the cottage, my neighbor next door, who has looked after us all winter and who has said to us, "We will do whatever it takes so that you may enjoy your life as our neighbors as long as you like." Well, I saw him on Monday when I drove down, and I said, "I talked about you in the sermon yesterday." "Yeah, yeah," he said. "No, I did. I was telling them what a wonderful neighbor you are. I never thought anything else about it, but on Thursday he emailed me. He said, 'I listened to your sermon on a set of headphones down in my basement. I'm glad my wife wasn't there. I had to wipe my eyes and blow my nose before she came down to hear it. No one has ever spoken about me like that before, and I was so touched and so grateful that you would remember me.' And he said, 'We will do anything it takes to keep you as our neighbors.' I nearly said, 'Well, the chimney needs rebuilding,' but I held back on that one. We all need to be valued and to belong. The church is full today because the line between life and death is thinner and more transparent than we realize. Peter came to Joppa from the city of Lydda, so we're told in the book of Acts. He came in response to the death of a great woman in the church at Joppa. She called out to him even in death. Her name was Tabitha, which meant gazelle, and she was the busy bee of the congregation. She held the place together like glue. And then she died. And they washed her, and they laid her out on her bed, and they gathered all her things around her by which they remembered. We do that at our own funerals. We take pictures, and we take items, and we set up those boards with all the scenes where mother or dad or grandmother was so much a part of the group. Peter sat with them a while as they wept, and then he dismissed them all, and he sat alone with the body of the woman lying in her bed, and he began to imagine all the things she had been. He may have even spoken to her despite himself and thanked her and praised her for her life. And the text says, somehow she came to life among them again. Years ago, when there were wars in Latin America — are there not always wars in Latin America? — it was the practice of some of the churches in the city to have evenings remembering those who were laying down their lives for the cause. And when names were known, names of those who had died in death squads and so on, at the service those names would be read aloud. And as each name was read out, the congregation would say as one voice, "Presente, I am here, presente." The name read, "Presente," and suddenly those who had given up their lives so willingly for others were present in our midst. The church is full today because all those who have ever been here and have been moved by the magic of the place are still here. The ones we love so much and the ones we deeply miss are still here. The intimacy of their caring still warms us, and their way of seeing things, their enthusiasm, and their wisdom about the place still runs deep in us. Years ago, George and Bindi Morrison came back to us. Now, George Morrison was a major executive with IBM in the 1960s and went into ministry late in life. He came here as a student and was remembered as just an excellent man, an excellent leader. He and his wife, Bindi, after he had served as the General Secretary of the United Church of Canada, retired to the far west coast to Salt Spring Island. And years later, in their age, they came back to Metropolitan one Sunday morning and sat right in the front row. It was so good to see them and meet them. George Morrison took me aside. He said, "I hadn't been back here in years, but as soon as I put one foot onto the park and stepped onto the lawn, I could feel the power and electricity of this place coursing through my body." The ones we loved so much and dearly miss are still very much here. When I leave this place, I shall carry all of you with me. I'll probably ride off into the sunset like Shane in the movie Shane, and I'll carry you as treasures in my saddlebags. You will be a heavenly host, seen and unseen, that feeds me every day. So the church is full today. Lift your eyes to the hills and see the horses and the chariots of God. Our saddlebags are filled with possibility. The church is full today because those who really love us still do. They are beside us and within us in our moments of spiritual yearning. Do you think the ones who loved you love you any less or love you more because they've died? What do you think of that? Do they love you less or do they love you more because they have died? I received an email the other night, a sad little email from a very bright friend of mine in Melbourne, Australia. She was the woman who took Elspeth and me under her wing on the two occasions when I preached there. And her husband, Miles, whom she adored, a wonderful doctor, they'd lived in Canada a while, died finally of heart complications about 2 years ago, and she was left on her own. She's gone back to university, she's doing a theology degree, Liz is 75 years old. But she emailed me the other day and she said, "Malcolm, I'm having a very sad day. It's unusual to have a really sad day, but I miss Miles so much. I can feel him around me, and our dog Hurley Boy, who loved him so much and sat at his feet every day, is currently sitting at my feet right now. And I just needed to tell you, though I push on with my work and have essays coming due, I'm having a sad day today, and I miss my heart and my heart's companion." And I thought a while, and I wrote back to her, and I said, "Perhaps missing somebody like that, perhaps moments of yearning like that, are really signs that those people are near us, really nearer us in those moments than they had been in the moments before. Our dearly beloved are more at liberty to be near us now because they are not bound by physicality or time or distance. You may well be finishing sentences later in your life that you and Miles, that you and your beloved shared with each other in conversation many years before." Now, in Joppa, at the house of Simon the Tanner, Peter was in a setting which was deemed unclean, ceremonially unclean. Think about Simon the Tanner. Simon the Tanner is someone who works with animal hides and soaks them in urine to make leather. Not a nice house to spend time in. Touching dead bodies and so on made him ceremonially unclean, and there was Peter living with him. And perhaps he went up onto the roof to get a brush of fresh air, who knows? But there he was up on the roof, and he saw the wideness and the variety of the world around him, and he saw the choices he'd been making in his life before him, and suddenly, says Luke, a great sail appeared, like those from his fishing boat days. It appeared above him, and in that sail was every creature in the world, and he heard a voice say to him, "Peter, rise up, kill and eat." It didn't only say it once, it said it three times to make the point. "Peter, rise up, kill and eat." And Peter said, "Oh, I can't do that. I don't eat this and I don't eat that. And I've never been to that kind of restaurant and I've stayed in my own town and I don't like the taste of that. It's too bitter, it's too sweet." And the voice said, "Do not call unclean what I call clean. You must be bigger and broader in your mind." That was Luke's message to the early church, the Gentile church in the ancient world. Be broad, for the love of God is broad in you. The Spirit falls on us, we grow tender and open, and we lay down our lives for our friends. I suddenly realized in thinking about this text that it was those who loved Peter the most who had lingered to lower down that sail. Mom and Dad, his little sister, the school teacher who loved his mind, the music teacher who loved his talent. The church is full today. The church is full today because God has no favorites. And do you hear how radical that is? God has no favorites. Our lives are usually hemmed in by walls and doors of favorites. We all have our favorites. We have our favorite neighborhoods and our favorite flavors and our favorite seasons and our favorite people. We distinguish ourselves by our favorites. But Luke has Peter declare, God has no favorites. Anyone on whom the Spirit falls and opens his or her life for the sake of another, laying down a life for a friend, is a favorite of God's. After the vision of the sail, Peter was summoned to meet Cornelius, a centurion in the Roman army. Now, people in the town spoke well of Cornelius. They said he was a lovely man and he helped the community. But Peter, coming from Galilee, took one look at him and saw enemy in Cornelius. After all, they knew the brutality of Rome in Galilee. For nearly a century, the Romans had marched all over them, destroying their lives. "Be careful, Peter," said a voice inside his head. But Luke says the Spirit fell, and they laid down their lives for each other, there and then, Cornelius and Peter. The church is full today because God has no favorites. And here's a controversial one. Here's one that speaks to the issues of the day and to the ambience of the place in which we live. The church is full today because all along we have been training soldiers for Christ. Can you say that in this day and age, soldiers for Christ? The hymn book committee took all the references to being soldiers out of the hymn book. It was too offensive somehow. Do you realize that the hymn Onward, Christian Soldiers was written by a rural Anglican priest in England for children to sing on Children's Sunday? "We are soldiers for Christ," says the hymn. We are in a battle for faith every day. Don't think we're not. We can take nothing for granted. If we want a wise, deep, and loving world, we shall have to fight for it, because our values are a threat to sinister places, people, and places who want to take them from us. That's always been the case. Here comes the interesting part. I was visiting with a man in hospital. He'd nearly died. He was in intensive care for a very long time, hovering between life and death. He was speaking through a bit of a haze, and he said to me, "I have had a companion with me all the way, and this companion would meet me and take me to places all over the world. Some of them were brutally violent, and I sat with them in the midst of wars and killing, and others were very, very beautiful. I asked him to take me to Metropolitan Church, my home, and we sat in the seats where I sit. And as I looked around, I saw that the church was filled with soldiers, wearing uniforms from every battle in every war. And as I watched them," he said, "suddenly they all began to rise together upward into the air." Strange vision. Well, a few weeks later, I was telling one of our other members here that story, and he said, "Strange thing. When I was sitting in my regular pew on Remembrance Sunday with my wife, I looked around and saw that the church was filled with soldiers. And suddenly as I watched, they all began to rise upwards into the air." The church is full today. It's full today because in honest moments we're taken out of ourselves to give thanks for things beyond our sight. Things that will blossom in us down the years. We are a hopeful people, and we will live in a world larger than the ones we know. We once holidayed in the southwest corner of Scotland, in Dumfriesshire. It was near the city of Dumfries, the place where Robert Burns had last lived and died, and we stayed near the Cistercian Abbey of Dundrennan. And we stayed in a little sheiling, and you could look down across the coast and see England in the distance. At the top of the little road was the ruin of an old chapel and a fenced cemetery. I used to climb over the stile there and sit in a little bench in the corner among the gravestones for a few moments of quiet reading. After doing that for a while, I came to realize that I needed to look at these stones. I spent time reading the names, and there was biography there. There were stories of lives there. Whole families who had died together of some mysterious illness that swept through a town. One woman whose house was blown up in the war, the only house in the village that was struck by a bomb. All other houses stood, she died, and on it went. And I began to see brave lives, living heart-wrenching tales. And since I was all alone, I began to speak to them there. And I began to thank them. Their simple living in that country across the world had somehow given me a base that I might live my life in my time in the richness of this country on this side of the world. The church is full today because we pause to give thanks to the people of the past for the gift of being alive in their time, and we are the beneficiaries. Well, we drove through Picton last summer, and the church had been sold and demolished. It was torn apart from steeple to base, and there was an empty parking lot in its place. So goodbye candy floss, goodbye bumper cars, goodbye parachute jumps. I don't have to talk to my sister-in-law anymore. But I need not wonder what it would be like to have my own church, because I have my own church. I have this church. And you have your own church, and we have it together. It's a broad church. It's a varied church and a curious church. It's a patient church. And it's an open church. A stranger can become a friend here. It's one of the most beautiful things about it. The Spirit falls here, people come alive here, and we become willing to lay down our lives for our friends. The two essential agreements of a great church. Well, God has no favorites, and any who feels the fall of the Spirit and who sacrifices others for their lives for their friends is a member here. We may disappoint some, and we may offend some, and we may mystify others, but by God's grace, we shall be the church in this place, and among our friends and among our saints. Today, the church is full.